freaking auto!
This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says? No, he's not a brenner.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
We stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
Oh, yeah, here we go with another Brock and Salk podcast. Hi, Brock. How are we doing today?
I'm doing well. Doing well. What is it, the three of the four horsemen?
Just three. Kyle's on a little vacay this week, so we got just Howdy.
Hi, Howdy. Bet you do.
Lucky us.
Howdy, can I ask you a super quick question before we dive in?
Ready.
Did you see, I don't know if it quite went viral, but I was checking something out last night on Twitter. I have never thought of this nor heard of it, but I'm guessing because you're a pork and beef connoisseur and maybe a hot dog connoisseur that you have. Bruce Pearl, coach of the number one Auburn Tigers men's basketball team, is a hot dog connoisseur. Did you see this?
No, I didn't see
this. And I had never thought nor heard of this idea. And afterwards, I'm like, gosh, I got to try that. So he grills his hot dogs, cooks them, whatever. And then his key is he throws the hot dogs right into the bag with the buns to steam the buns. So the hot dogs go in hot into the plastic bag, wraps it, steams the buns while the hot dogs are still steaming hot.
Hold on. Let me just make sure I understand. Does the hot dog go into the bun and then the bun in the bag?
Nope.
Or the buns are in the bag and then you jam the hot dogs in
then
around
throw
them?
Throw the hot dogs in.
It's not a ton of room in that bag,
not
is there?
Not a ton of room. Not a ton
but
of room.
But enough for some hot
but enough.
Dogs.
Yeah. But enough. And it just steams the buns.
I got some questions about that.
Okay.
That sounds horrible.
Like, why do you want your buns soggy? Don't you want your buns on the grill so that they crisp up a little bit and get a little crunchy? What am I missing?
Well, I think that's a fair question, but like, I think the Costco
hot
dog.
Watery bun?
I think the no, just steamed. You just steamed.
Sounds kind of watery. What do you steam with? Something other than water? I mean, steam is water.
I understand. See, to me, like the Costco hot dog is the number one of number ones. The bun kind of is not crispy. It's just kind of sticky all
it's
around the
like
hot dog.
A corn base.
Gosh, it's
yeah,
good.
Real thick.
Real good.
Mm-hmm. I
real
want good. My buns to be almost burnt. Like I want.
Oh,
like,
you like
not
them
quite,
crispy?
Yeah, and what
okay.
I and if a really good bun, I want to take a little olive oil or butter and get it onto the bun,
gotcha.
And then grill that
grill
so
it
gets
get
some
it
of that
toasty.
Real
yeah,
grilled.
Good. No, that's good too.
Because the best hot dog I've ever had would be at the Nile Golf Course and the German dog. That's what they do. They fully throw that thing right on their grill, all buttered up.
I knew you were going Nile Dog.
Just Howdy, where's the best hot dog you've ever had?
Man, honestly, it's a little outside the box, but there is a...
outside the bun.
There's a little outside the bun. In Pike Place Market, there is a little truck that sells bagel dogs.
Oh, yeah.
And they are hot dogs that are cooked inside of a bagel.
Yes.
So they're almost like a croissant, but it's like a bagel.
Wow.
And then it's stuffed with cream cheese.
Hold on. Let's end this podcast. There you go. I got something I got to take care of
that's
down the market.
That's the best I've ever had.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That head down there,
good.
Maybe hit up Sazio's and pick up a bagel dog before this day is done. That sounds pretty good. It was a heck of a weekend, man. There's no reason to wait any longer. As bad as last week was, right? We're sort of talking about wild card weekend being kind of a dud. Not the divisional round. That is spectacular football. And it's not that every game was played at the absolute highest level, right? I would say that the last one was certainly Bills and Chiefs. The other three were kind of funky in it. And I don't know. I said this a few times, Brock. I think you actually kind of agreed with me, but it felt like those three games were lost, whereas the fourth game was truly won. But it led to great drama all the way through.
Agreed. I think that is exactly how to put it, that those teams that did lose are all kicking themselves. And even the one that won, Kansas City, their loser participant in that one is probably the hardest of all to swallow.
Maybe.
Right? Because Bills fans going
to
say, hold on a second. How many times? 100 times. Bill Belichick has 100 occasions where he has a 3-point lead with 13 seconds to go. He's not losing one, two. I mean, he's not losing that game situation.
No.
So a Bills fan, I think, listens to you say that and go, you got to be kidding me. Salk, We lost, too. That's ridiculous. You can't give a game away.
But also, Kansas City did so much to win that game.
Correct.
That it's hard to say Buffalo jumped. Exactly. Whereas, I mean, Green Bay imploded on special teams to lose that game.
Yep.
And the call made by Bruce Arians and Todd Bowles on the defense and not communicating it, they blew that game and really didn't play well throughout the entirety of that game and then blew it late. And then Ryan Tannehill, you can't throw a pick with 20 seconds left in that spot. You just can't.
Nope.
You can throw an incomplete punt and see what happens in overtime. And if you lose, you lose. But you can't throw a pick inside your own 50 at the end of a game. Like, that's ridiculous. That's losing a game.
You can't lose a game when you sack the opposing quarterback 9 times. You can't. You can't lose a game. You created 9 momentous negative plays in your building, and you still lose. Mm-hmm. By the way, side note on that.
Yeah.
Damon Heward. I believe his first start, or did he come in injured, against the New England Patriots, was sacked 9 times.
Oh, really? Good day for Damon.
And won. Had a game-winning drive at the end to
beat the Patriots. Say it. Maybe it's actually the thing. Like, you're supposed to get sacked 9 times in order to win. It's a little a loophole in a way to win ball games.
But the ratings, whether it's winners or losers, high level, low level, the ratings, did you see those yesterday?
No, were they ridiculous?
Oh, my gosh.
How could they not be?
Almost 45 million for the Kansas City Buffalo. I mean, that's nearing a Super Bowl level, right? Super Bowl's 51, or no, Super Bowl 100 million? No. 50-51. So 45 million watched that one.
That's a lot.
Absolutely insane. The week before, Dallas San Fran was 40 million. I think all four of those exceeded, even the Cincinnati one exceeded anything near it in that window on CBS in previous years. I mean, it's just insanity.
What is it? So why are we here? Why are we here in this world right now where the NFL can put out a slate of games like that?
Lots of star power. Incredible high-level quarterback play, young guys, veteran guys, Joe Burrow year 2, Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady 39 and 45, right? The whole spectrum and gamut there, other star power, coaching, environments, Green Bay in the snow. I mean, the NFL, if you throw in, you know, a plot, how do I get a great screen right? How do I put a book together? What is a story that people will want to buy? It has so many characters, so many environments, a ton of history thrown into the mix, and you throw it all together and there is nothing on television right now like the NFL. I said to you Monday, because one of my producers at Fox said this to me, like, geez, I hope the ink is dried, you know, because all those networks redid their deals, right? Amazon got in, Fox redid theirs, CBS, they all kind of got their extensions to those deals. And based on these numbers and this season, I think most of those networks got a pretty good deal, pretty good bargain, because everybody seemingly watches those games and did over the weekend.
It was fun. So now what? What do we learn from it? We saw what won. I mean, one, the best quarterback in football won. The upcoming potential one day, you know, top 5 quarterback or 3 quarterback in Josh Allen didn't win, but impressed the world. Joe Burrow, who's the young Tom Brady in your view, won. There were 2 teams that don't have elite franchise quarterbacks. One won, one lost. Right, Aaron Rodgers lost again. He's 11-10 in the playoffs. Amazing. Tom Brady, which is bizarre, right?
Mm.
But you know, part of his legacy. We're talking a little bit about legacy. We're not going to like exclude the fact that Aaron Rodgers is now 11-10 in the postseason. Matt Stafford, who'd never won a postseason game, all of a sudden gets one off his back, and he comes out and throws over 300 yards, no picks, and he gets a win. I mean, what do you make of? What do you take away from all of that? Is there a theme you can? Because I don't know that there is one. I've been kind of searching for it. I don't know that I came away with one conclusion watching the 4 games.
There's, I think, probably one for me outside of the quarterback situation. And I know in years past, I've always pointed to the rushing yards and however you go about it, whether you build a lead and you run it late or whether you just pound it and wear people down and get those yards. I don't think that's necessarily playing out this year. But I couldn't help but watch those games. And you see why year after year after year, as much as quarterbacks, Mike, are overdrafted, defensive tackles and defensive ends are as well. And it is a front four league that solves a lot of other riddles. The Rams are not good on the secondary. They're beat up at safety, got backups to backups, and pretty decent to, I mean, very league average linebackers.
And they're starting Eric Weddle.
But that front four, yeah, starting Eric Weddle off the couch, a couple other linebackers that are just, you know, as I said, very league average. But your front four is that dominant that you can beat. And if any team has any weakness, and losing Wirfs was enormous for the Buccaneers, you get totally exposed and you brutalize the greatest quarterback of all time. Like, you just hammer him and brutalize him. Obviously, Tennessee's front sacks Joe Burrow 9 times, gives them every opportunity to win if their quarterback doesn't give it away 3 different times. So I think that front four, San Francisco and Bosa and Armstead and those guys, go to Green Bay and it's a 3-and-out and it's a 3-and-out and it's a 3-and-out. And while they can really run at the second level, that's more of an entire front seven. Their front four is still incredibly dominant with Bosa and Armstead.
So I'm glad you go there, because that's sort of where I've been over the course of this week and talking about where the Seahawks are at. You know, everyone pays attention to the last game, and you got to build around a quarterback and the offense. And it's amazing to me how we forget, right? And just every year people see games like that and forget. Well, let's go back. Greatest show on turf, beaten by the Patriots defense. 2007, the Patriots, 18-0, with a crazy offense. Randy Moss, Tom Brady, Wes Welker, etc. Beaten by the Giants and their defensive front and what they did there. 2013, anybody remember that game? What happened in the Super Bowl that year when Peyton Manning and his unstoppable offense showed up? And guess what happened? The Seahawks found a way to beat them with an incredible defense that just pounded them. Mm-hmm. You can go back to
Broncos beating the MVP Cam Newton
sure.
He couldn't lift his arm, and remember, he had his vertebrae poking
Von
in his neck.
Miller
Clayton and said he couldn't look to his left.
Absolutely, it's true.
But Von Miller in that front four. Yes. Just decimate.
Who's the other guy? Who's the other guy in that front four? Was really good.
DeMarcus Ware.
Yes, DeMarcus Ware. Mm-hmm. And then you could go back as far as, oh, I don't know, last year when Patrick Mahomes brought his unstoppable offense to the Super Bowl, and guess what? The Bucs won not because of Tom Brady and Rob Gronkowski. Not that those guys were bad. It's not like they hurt, but that's not why they won the game. Nope. They shut down the incredible offense. Would they score 3 points in that game or something? They
took
killed them.
Took it to him.
They took it to him with their front seven and specifically those guys in the front of the defense. So, you know, if you're the Seahawks, and Jake and I have been kind of going back and forth and you know, firing shots from one show to the other, mostly, you know, in good spirits. But where we finally agree, and he said this yesterday, and I'll agree with him, the Seahawks need to pick what they want to be elite at and do it. I agree. And it should have nothing to do with the offense. It should have everything to do with their defense. We have been talking and arguing and mumbling back and forth now for 5 years. And the Seahawks' problem at no point in that time has been their offense. The problem is that they haven't invested enough and created the kind of defense that brought them a championship. Where's that? Where's the front seven that the Seahawks had when they were winning Super Bowls? Where's the Legion of Boom defense? I don't care about their offense. They lost the Cowboys playoff game because of their defense. They lost the Rams playoff game because of their defense. They didn't make the playoffs this year and had the problems at the beginning of last year because of their defense. Yeah, Russ's got to be healthy and all that, but I trust Russ to do enough by himself with what he's got, and DK and Tyler and a couple other guys, to win. Where is your championship-level defense? They haven't had one in 6 years.
Was it hard to watch Jaren Reed and Frank Clark for you?
Yes.
Because that's the other team I didn't throw into the front four.
It was. But
throw Chris Jones in there.
Yes.
In front, you at least got after Josh Allen.
Yes.
Got him off the field a couple times, created some havoc, forced him to run around and move, which he was capable of, and very few are in this league at his size. He probably avoided 4 or 5 sacks in the third and fourth quarter himself.
I didn't want to ask it on social media because it's just it's there's no nuance there, and it's just, I don't know, I didn't feel like it. But if, you know, take away the human beings, because Bobby Wagner's an incredible person, and I'm not sure either Frank Clark or Jaren Reed fall into that category. But who would you rather have?
Yeah.
Bobby Wagner and Al Woods, who's a good player. I mean, that's not a shot at Al Woods, or Puna Ford, or Jaren Reed and Frank Clark.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's close. Give me the edge rusher and the disruptive defensive tackle compared to a middle linebacker who's not as aggressive as he used to and doesn't make plays in the backfield and impact plays, and another defensive tackle who's good. Like, it's not even close.
Was that Rashad Penny, by the way, that Frank got traded for? The first round? Who did that first round pick turn into?
No, it was not that year. It was the LJ Collier year.
Oh.
So they traded back twice and ended up with LJ Collier. But it was not that he got traded for that spot.
Gotcha.
I was looking this up the other day because of the Jeffrey Simmons, who went 19th that year. I was trying to figure out where the Seahawks drafted. They drafted 21st and then 30th with the
gotcha.
So that's how that went.
They ended up getting basically LJ Collier, Damian Lewis, and Alton Robinson.
Yeah.
That's eventually what they ended up getting after that deal.
Which has been a big theme. You know, I think we hit on it a little bit today, Salk, on your show, and that is the off seasons. And I know it has been an enormous theme for Jake Heaps as he argues this. And he argued it a couple years ago. So did Howdy. So did many of us. And that was, sheesh, that year you had all of that salary cap space, all of that opportunity, and you went like you do in the draft. For volume.
Yeah, 2 years ago, right? That's the year.
2 years ago, yes. You went for volume. I'm going to take as many bites at the apple. I don't want one big apple. I want to take a ton of different little nibbles at this apple and get volume and get three, as it turns out, one starting O-lineman and Shell. The other guys couldn't really play. Finney, you ended up trading, right? So you went volume, and you've gone volume. And, you know, we'll go Benson Mayoa, and we'll go volume instead of what the Rams have done, and that is just give me a superstar, what the Chiefs in many ways have done. And, hey, man, you got your offensive guys. Now let's go big. You
know, that year, the Seahawks did this 2 years ago. I'll read it. It was Greg Olsen, bust. Cedric Abuehi, bust. Brandon Shell started, but not particularly well. I mean, it's not like he was a difference maker. Bruce Irvin, injured, bust. B.J. Finney, bad, bust. Luke Wilson did nothing and ended up retiring. Chance Warmack, nothing, bust. Philip Dorsett, nothing, bust. Benson Mayoa, okay, fine player. I mean, like, he was serviceable value. 2 years ago.
You got value out of him.
You got
and
what
Shell.
You wanted out of him.
That was fine. Mike Iupati, I mean, fine, not a difference maker. He didn't make you significantly better, and that's your offseason.
Yeah.
In the meantime, Jack Conklin is out there. You could have had him instead of those three offensive linemen. You'd be better. Just be better.
This strategy has been the John Schneider strategy since they got here, right? And it worked for a while. And what's the reason?
So are you saying that, just so I clarify, are you saying that Cliff Avril and Michael Bennett would be part of that strategy?
Yes, they would, because neither one of them were top of the market free agents at their position.
They were close, though.
They were short-term deals, 1 to 2 to 3 year deals at not top of the market.
That's
prices.
True, but that was also but that was only because of that specific year had like 8 good pass rushers out
correct.
There.
All the same, they did not break the market to sign one of the free agent
guys. They
did
not. Who was the guy that went to the Browns or Ravens? Kruger.
Yeah, Paul Kruger.
He was at the top of the market, and he would have been a bust.
There were 5 or 6 guys ahead of Cliff Avril that they got.
There were a couple guys that were ahead of him.
It's not like they got the cream of the crop guy, the guy that everybody wanted.
But that year was flooded with those kinds of people. Since then, since Cliff Avril and Michael Bennett, what's the best free agent signing the Seahawks have made? Michael Sean Dugar asked this, so I'm stealing his question. I think it's a good one. It's a good exercise. Take trades out of it. What's the best free agent signing the Seahawks have had since then?
And that was the 2013.
I don't hear you answering
2014,
my question.
2013.
Leading into 2013. It was
Frank
the 12-13.
So we're talking
Gore?
9 years.
I mean, it's probably Gerald Everett. And I'm not, I don't think he did anything particularly great this year, but that's probably the right answer is Gerald Everett. Yeah, not re-signing your own guys, not trades. Who's the best free agent the Seahawks have signed since that 2012-13 offseason? It's probably Gerald Everett. Whew. Right? It's not Eddie Lacy. It's not Luke Jokel. It's not Brandon Shell. It's not Cedric Abuehi. Right?
Mm-mm.
I mean, really, go through it.
A couple corners have been flamed out.
DJ Reed was fine. I mean, maybe you want to put DJ Reed in there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that kind of worked out for them. So, okay, give credit on DJ Reed. He's somebody who was cut, right? And so you end up kind of picking him up. That felt like kind of somebody who emerged almost accidentally, but all right, cool. You get credit for that, obviously. They haven't had really a good a great free agent signing since Cliff Avril and Michael Bennett.
Marshawn.
Trade.
Well, the original, and then he went to the Raiders, and he was a free agent.
No, come on. No, I stop. I mean, like,
Justin Coleman was a trade. He was a good player.
Yeah.
Quandre Diggs was a trade. Jadeveon Clowney was a trade. Dwayne Brown was a trade. Now, part of this is, because they have not gone crazy in free agency, has that opened the door and allowed them to be able to make some of those trades?
Yes.
Yeah, probably. Yep.
But there's an easy opposite side of the coin on that, isn't there?
Yes.
That you can get high caliber players and keep cap space, right? The reason why this strategy worked in the beginning, getting volume in free agency and volume in the draft, is because they drafted so well they could count on the draft to develop impact players, and then you can get average players in free agency to supplement that. When you fail at both of those and you don't get any impact in the draft, and then you keep your free agent strategy to get average players,
you end up a team with no impact.
Exactly.
And then
that's where they are.
And then, oh, by the way, the guys that you decide to keep don't give you the impact plays, and I'm looking at Bobby Wagner, unfortunately, and this year Russell Wilson. Yeah, that's where you end up. Absolutely. Tyler Lockett would be an exception to that. They kept him, and he's given them every bit of that value and more. But I, you're right, Howdy. So what do you do now differently this year? I'd like to see them be aggressive in free agency. We talked about 5-point plan to go fix this defense, Brock, and the two things you need to acquire in order to do that from the outside are a pass rusher and an edge and an interior disruptor, kind of like the two guys we were just talking about, Frank Clark and Jaron Reed.
As you look at these four teams, by the way, back to your initial question that led kind of to this exercise and out and down this rabbit hole, Cincy, Kansas City, San Francisco, L.A., from this conversation of acquisition, how have they done it? The Rams have said the heck with any first-round picks, right? I think this year they've got, right now as it sits, a fifth-rounder and 2 7th-rounders. That's it. They've just traded and said, you know what, here's Von Miller and here's Jalen Ramsey, and we are going all in, and we are not using draft capital, and they really have not had first-round picks forever. With McVay and Lesney, they've gone that route. San Francisco has been fortunate. They've had some boom and bust. They've had a couple years that just busted with injuries and put them in the top 10, and they got difference-making draft picks. Bosa, Armstead, the kid that kicked over to Indianapolis and added, you know, a few more pieces with. So they have been kind of unique, you know, in that they've really capitalized on some bad years, not that they've tanked, but because of injuries, they've gotten some star power, and they've been pretty shrewd and pretty savvy. Kansas City has said, you know what, we've got top of the market, and Kelsey, and Tyreek, and Mahomes, and Frank, and Matthew, and we'll pay those guys, and it's going to have to just be fill in the rest, right? I mean, just a bunch of... And they, thankfully for them, have hit on some young draft picks, some linebackers that are difference makers, and they've kept some of their draft and develop and gone that route. And since he's been a mix and had the number one pick, and he's a difference maker. So I don't know necessarily if any of those four say, yep, this is exactly the way you have to do it in this league today.
But I'm not saying they need to go out and get the best players on their team through free agency. I'm saying they need to look at the holes they have and find better players than what they've got in free agency. Jaron Reed's a free agent. In Kansas City, I know, because he left here in free agency. They cut him, and the Chiefs picked him up. That's a difference maker for them. How? I mean, would the Seahawks be a better team right now if they had Jaron Reed? Yes. Flat out, yes. Right?
Yeah, when Jaron Reed was motivated, when Jaron Reed was fit, when Jaron Reed was able, he was a 10-sack
come up with
guy.
A pretty good sack the other day. He looked pretty good. I mean, I haven't watched every game closely, but he's...
And he's going to be a free agent and wants to get his bag. And is he going to be that same guy that he is right now that's highly
motivated?
Brock,
you say that kind of about everybody, though. So, like, in your world, like, everyone does that, like, once in a while. And then, like, you say that about everybody.
Not everybody.
Yes, you do.
Not quarterbacks. Not the great quarterbacks.
You say that about almost everybody.
When you have been scarred and burned and you watch people shut it down, as I did, especially at that position group, Mike, you do learn your lessons from that. That position group, more than any other, works to get their deal. Where it works to make their money, and then I could chill for a couple of years. Oh, I'm nearing the end of my contract. I better turn it up. I better ratchet it up. That position group does it more than anybody else.
Do you remember Brock Heward, like the one who started the Brock and Salk show in 2009?
Yeah, what about him?
Where did he go?
Wow. What are you talking about?
What do you mean, what am I talking about?
I made that like point I have year one.
False. I feel...
absolutely
what?
Not. I called them
maybe,
big C.
Maybe
I
in your own head.
I called them walruses.
Maybe
like,
in your own head you
no,
said... You called,
I called
them, walruses,
them walruses
like 5 years later.
Players never shut it down. They're
Brock.
Professionals.
Right.
Exactly. That's
no,
what we would have heard.
No, you're confusing me with Dave Wyman.
No, I'm not.
Yes,
I know
you
who
are.
I'm talking to.
You, in
you
this
might
case,
have nodded something about... Well, I just feel like I've created a cynical monster.
No, I know.
No. My memory's pretty good.
Right,
I was just about to talk about how they traded Daryl Tapp for Chris Clemens. My memory is just fine. Thank you. I play dumb now and again, but my memory is actually, it's actually terrible. But I can't believe you over the years and how much, you know, you've grown. I love you. I love how much you've changed.
You too, Salk. I've gone from zero cynicism to probably 40.
What?
And you've gone from 100 to probably 60. So we're
I don't know. I feel like you're more cynical than I am half the time.
Oh, get out of here. You're crazy.
I don't know that I am. I honestly think there are times. I think there are times. I think that there are times you are more cynical now than me.
Mm.
What do you think, Howdy?
I think absolutely. Absolutely. But it has more to do with his like emotional reactions to what he's watching in the moment.
Brock.
He's so much more cynical in the moment than he ever was.
What are you talking about? You two both have darts in your neck.
No. Yes. Look, if Howdy and I agree, you generally know that it's right.
Kyle?
Yes. Kyle's not here. There's nobody to save you. Yeah, you've really become quite the cynical man as you've gotten older and late here in life. Good. Hey, I know you're not too cynical for a little happy hour, Brock, and you know it tastes better way up high in the sky. 31st floor action, Lincoln South Tower. Take a little happy hour to new heights at Ascend Prime Steak and Sushi in downtown Bellevue. Served twice every day, 3 to 6, 9 to close in the lounge. Sip mixologist crafted libations from the award-winning list. And here's some of the dishes that you can enjoy. Sushi tacos, a.k.a. the crispy wontons, little ginger carrot slaw, wafu daikon oroshi, fresh mango, your choice of tuna and tabiko, hamachi negi, or king salmon and ikura. How does that sound?
Yes.
Yummy.
Sold. I shouldn't even read some of this at the state of hunger I'm in at the moment, but Korean style karaage, aka crispy chicken with gochujang chili, foie gras snow, celery, and almond foie butter. I love karaage chicken. I love fried chicken pretty much of any sort, but that's just so good. Nitamago deviled eggs, yes, aka the soy poached eggs topped with bacon pea jam, slow braised korobuta pork belly, or the Ascend Steakhouse Wagyu burger. Brock and I dined and ate that burger, arms intertwined like the swans. I was feeding
swan necks.
Yes, I was feeding myself my burger bite around his arm while he ate. That's how we said goodbye to each other when the Daily Show ended. It's dry aged and Wagyu blend burger patty, white cheddar, medium egg, crispy shallot, arugula frisée, and a brioche bun. That's pretty good right there. You can learn more, make reservations for happy hour at ascendprime.com. All right, Brock, I got a whole bunch of questions for you here. You ready? Some will be Seahawks related. Some will be a little bit more NFL related or a little potpourri type of action. We now have 9 coaching vacancies with Sean Payton deciding he's done in New Orleans. Sounds like one is about to get filled with Byron Leftwich. And by the time this comes out, that may have happened. But either way, 8 or 9, what's going to happen? Are we going to start seeing anybody actually choose a coach?
Crazy. And I think that is affecting the Seahawks because they're trying what's been 8 or 9 days since they fired Ken Norton. And, you know, we spent some time talking about those coordinators. By the way, Wink Martindale, no chance. Just want to make that very clear. Really nice man, Buddy Ryan Tree, Blitzer, all of that stuff. And he'll land somewhere, just not with Pete Carroll. So I would sure like this, whether Dan Quinn is the big domino that everybody's waiting for, because it seems like he's interviewed in 7 spots and is wanted in a bunch of them in 2nd interviews. I sure hope the dominoes start to fall and staff start to get put together and the Seahawks can figure out what, you know, they want to do and hopefully get the guy, most importantly, they really want and not have to settle at that defensive coordinator position.
Do you think that's Gus Bradley? Because, I mean, that's one guy they'd really be waiting on. Now, there's some others, right, who are
coming. Now, they're not even talk to Gus, right?
I know, but I don't think you can interview him, right, because Rich Bisacci has been in that spot?
Possibly, but I think these other guys, don't know some of the rules as far as that goes, but the guy from Chicago, they were able to interview, and they're trying to figure out their coaching situation. Yeah. So I don't know. We've not seen Gus's name attached by anybody.
I know.
To Seattle. And I don't think that's just because of rules and regulations and everything else.
Yeah.
So I would like this to get done because I do think it has a Seahawk effect because they need to figure out who their D coordinator is. And with all of these head jobs, Mike, there's going to be massive opportunity for coordinators and many talented coordinators to figure out where they want to go and who they want to land with as well. I think it also, by the way, shows you, and you and I debated this morning on your show on Wednesday morning. You and I debated. I think this to me is also a little telling of just where the head coach is and the pecking order of importance in the NFL. That it's owner, that it's quarterback, and then it's head coach. And you, depending on GM or that situation, relationship with GM, front office, what all that looks like, because there's different dynamics. But I think this also does point to that, man, it is imperative to have an owner that cares, that is committed, is willing to spend and make the moves necessary. And then as these playoffs and the divisional round showed you,
so
you better have a quarterback.
So I'm trying to think there. We certainly have examples of coaches who were not necessarily anything until they ended up with a quarterback, right? And then after, yes. Like, I mean, Sean Payton's a good example here, where after the quarterback leaves, he's like, yeah, I guess I'm done. Do we have examples of quarterbacks who were not necessarily much of anything until they hooked up with the right head coach and ended up becoming franchise quarterbacks at that point?
Well, Tom Brady was on practice squad. And
yeah,
he
but he's with Belichick
rounder.
The whole time.
He's been with him the entire time.
Can you think of a quarterback who was good, went somewhere else, and became great?
Kurt Warner, obviously, his whole story. He went yes. to Green Bay, got cut. Mariucci is like, eh. Goes to the Rams, and if you watch the movie, Martz didn't really like him and eventually gained his trust. And then he took off, bounced around a few different spots, went back to a Super Bowl
with
Arizona.
Yeah, I don't know
Arizona.
If that quite counts, though. I mean, the guy didn't play until he started playing in St. Louis.
Correct.
I'm talking about a quarterback, and this is I'm trying to prove your point for you, even though you and I argued about it, because I don't know how strongly I feel. I was just sort of being argumentative. Mm-hmm. Come up with an example of a quarterback that was good, not great, played, got the right head coach, and became great.
Yeah, I mean, Tannehill, it would have been, as far as right now, if he didn't throw a couple picks in the game.
Yeah, so he's on my list.
Goes to Miami, yeah. Right, and gets paid and then gets benched and has to kind of resurrect himself and find himself there. I mean, you look around, Mike, there's a bunch of teams all around the NFL that have tried to find that guy. I mean, the Denver Broncos tried to do it with Joe Flacco, tried to do it with Case Keenum, tried to do it with Teddy Bridgewater.
Alex Smith's probably the best one.
But he was pretty good when he was in San Francisco.
He was okay in San Francisco, and then he went to the Chiefs and was amazing.
He was certainly better, but I mean, he was pretty good. He was, you know, he helped them get to a Super Bowl when he was in San Francisco. I mean, like,
no,
Alex Smith was pretty good.
Championship game.
That's true. Championship game. You're right. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, so there's not many, man. There's not many where you
as
go.
As compared to the opposite of like the coaches yes. who are like, you were nothing, and then you got the franchise quarterback,
correct.
And you became the guy. So if that's the case, does it matter what the Seahawks do with Pete Carroll? For all of the conversation of like Pete's holding back Russ and this and that, like, does it matter?
It is why the Let Russ Cook, you know, crowd just storms the gates, and it's like it should be about him. He should be. You saw the tweet that someone tweeted to you and me about Josh Allen, who's going to be very involved in the next coordinator hire, and right that the head coach even said that.
Well, it depends. Absolutely. Have all those quarterbacks been given carte blanche, or did it just not matter who the coach was?
Yeah. No, I think coaching and culture still matters. Nothing like college football. College football, the head coach is the general.
For
he
sure.
has to be the GM, the head coach, the schemer, the talent acquisition.
Well, otherwise,
all
you never
of it.
Win. The quarterbacks are all terrible. So, I mean, like, it's the best. Of course, like, you need the coach to be good.
They are the culture builder. They are the schemer. They're all of it. Get to the NFL level, and you know that we talked in the last segment about kind of the takeaways of this weekend and everything else. And it's just, you know, when you have an Allen and you have a Mahomes and you have a Brady and. I mean, Bruce Arians won a Super Bowl with Tom Brady, right? McVay got kind of his guy that he wanted. He betted on him. And I mean, I'm not going to put Stafford in that camp because I always thought he was pretty good in Detroit in a horrible organization. But he comes to L.A. this year, and he shows you what his ceiling is.
Is that your example then? That Matt Stafford is a quarterback that was good but never won a playoff game until he got the right coach or the right ownership and organization around him.
I think that is a lot right. more about organization. That sheesh, Detroit had been so bad and so much turnover and so just
also
bad.
Doesn't hurt having Aaron Donald and Leonard Floyd and the rest
Odell
of
Beckham
Miller,
and Cooper Kupp
kind of the rest
and the good
of
old line
Toronto.
And yep. Takes yeah, that, all those pieces.
That doesn't hurt. All right, you want to argue a little bit, Brock, speaking of potpourri. Are you ready to change the overtime rules now that everyone in the world has seen how absolutely ridiculous they are once again in the postseason?
Because it's really bad for the NFL. It's really affecting their
I didn't say it was bad for the NFL. It's just unfair.
I think I'm going to give some credit to the young lady that grabbed the bull by the hands.
Yes.
And I think she nailed it in your little tweet.
That's my wife, Heather.
Yep. Heather, who said to you, and it kind of crystallized for you, like, should it really come down to the luck of a coin flip? And I, you know, you brought this up on Tuesday, I believe. You brought it up this week, and I would be just fine awarding the home team the ball. Because in the regular season, what is it, about 50% of the time in the regular season, a little over 50, 55%, whoever wins the toss ultimately wins it. So it's a coin flip in the regular season, figuratively and literally. And to get to the postseason, it's over 90%, right?
It's 10 out of 11. The team that has won the toss has won the game. And in 7 of those 11, they've just taken the ball down and scored and left somebody on the bench who, you know, and part of that, I think, is because once you get to the postseason, it's mostly franchise quarterbacks playing against each other, right? The best of the best. And the offenses do have an advantage. I know that Schlereth and others are out there saying, well, defense is part of the game, too. It's funny. We were talking to Hasselbeck this morning, and he was telling a story about the competition committee and how they brought in some of the safeties when they were making the changes to the rules about how hard you could hit guys, defenseless receivers. Uh-huh. And one of the ways, I think he was saying it was Mike Tomlin, but the way they were explaining it was like, hey, yeah, we're not going to expect you to make that play anymore. Well, what do you mean? Like, that guy comes across the middle, he's going to catch the ball. Yeah, that's now a catch. Like, you're just not going to take their head off and stop them. You're going to catch them and stop them from gaining more yards. That is an unbelievable change, which benefits the offense, and they are not making, that's one of a few. They are not making equivalent changes to benefit the defense. So, yeah, defense is part of the game, too, is true, but it's not, even if we take special teams out of it, 50% of the game. Not anymore.
I mean,
not the way the league is played.
You didn't have this conversation with Matt, right?
About a little bit. Yeah, a little.
Because we're going to take the ball. And we're
I know. He knows. But that, by the way, he mentioned that in that game, that was not even their first possession. They had the ball. Then Green Bay had the ball. Then they had the ball. That was actually the third possession of that game.
Wow.
Look, it's not to say that games can't go that way. Of course they can. Teams do stop you all the time. It's not impossible. It's just a matter of trying to make it as fair as possible once you get to overtime. And for people who say the life's not fair, yeah, no kidding. But that's not a good reason why overtime shouldn't be even for both teams. Like, yeah, all right, but that doesn't mean we don't try to make life fair.
Do people say, I grew up two blocks from the fair?
It used to like be the Pierrot
Fair. Yeah, yes. Like I did.
I don't know. To me, this seems like one of those no-brainers. I mean, the solution of giving the home team the ball to me is a compromise. I still believe that both teams should touch the ball, and you should find a way to even that out or play a full quarter, whatever the case may be.
Well, baseball has it perfect, and you guys ranked postseasons like the best post or the best extra
baseball
rules.
And hockey are the best
baseball, and the way it is basically you match the score.
Yep.
I score two runs, you got to score at least two runs. I love that idea. Take the timer off the clock, and we go back and forth until one team has a drive that's more successful than the other.
I wouldn't have a problem
with
that.
Both sides get the ball.
And if you want to force them to go for two in order to, you know, kind of move things, I'd be fine with that as well. You're still playing football, so it's not like you get the ball at the 20, the opposing 20, like in college. Make them play football, because this is the playoffs in the NFL. You don't have to do it during the regular season, but in the playoffs, you should do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would absolutely be in favor. Or that it just look, I was rooting for the Chiefs. I was psyched the way it ended the other day. I was rooting for the Seahawks in 2014, and I was like, you know what I mean?
Yep.
It was great that it worked out that way.
Yep.
But it doesn't make it right. Aaron Rodgers should have touched the ball also, just like Russell Wilson got to, Josh Allen should have also.
I think the challenge, Howdy, with your going back and forth and back, and you even saw in that game, I mean, Buffalo was just done. Both defenses were just done.
Yes.
They're just totally out of gas. And you know what? In the playoffs, okay, fine. It's playoffs, sudden death, your season ends. You could never do that in the regular season. And I know player safety gets joked at and laughed at.
I'm fine with that.
I
don't care about the regular season, Brock. Yeah,
those
I'm with you.
Are out of gas. And totally out of gas. So you couldn't, I don't know if you'd, yeah, I just don't know if players and coaches would be aboard.
Brock, I'd be fine with the game ending in a tie in a regular season. I don't care. Don't play overtime if you don't want to. But in the postseason, where advancing to the Super Bowl is on the line, you cannot allow it. It doesn't make any sense.
You were this upset, even though the team you're rooting for won.
Yes, because I've been this upset about this for years.
The Bills had won the toss.
I've been upset every time. And I was upset when the Patriots beat the Chiefs a few years ago with the same reason. Made no sense.
53-53. It's not 22-22.
Right. That's also a very good point. But if for some reason that's impossible, the best compromise, you sort of mentioned it, would be to, and this borrows from baseball a little bit, give the advantage to the team that has deserved it. there's an advantage to being up last in baseball, right? You get last ups if you're at home. Somebody has to do it, so we've assigned the home team. Mm-hmm. And in general, other than in the World Series, and by the way, I would change that as well, we give home field advantage to the team that had the better record in the regular season.
Yep.
Why can't we do that with this? If you have to award one team the ball and you're not willing to change from a sudden death situation like this, why not reward the team that had a better regular season?
Agreed.
And give them the ball at least and admit that this is an advantage that they get, but they earned it because they went 15-2 and you went 13-4. Okay, fine. I can accept that.
So I know your 5-yard, 10-yard holding deal right now is kind of working its way through
Pereira and Ladino. Yes.
So I don't know if you're going to be able to get them on the horn to do this as well. I think it'd be too much. I think
it might be. This one, actually, though, Sando was a part of this also. So I'm going to give some credit to Mike Sando. He helped kind of create and craft that.
Oh, good. Okay.
Just give some.
You want to give him the scraps? Say, hey, I'll put you in touch with Blandino.
Call it the Sando rule. I don't care. Yes. Like, I don't need credit. Just fix it, because what they have right now is not fair. Brock, I'm going to give you one NFL quarterback for the next 4 years. Who do you want?
Mahomes.
Right.
Yeah.
Duh. Is this even a hard question?
No.
Well, he struggled at the start of this year, and you also get his TikTok brother, who's a TikTok.
Oh, I don't want him on my team. I just want, like, I'm sorry. I thought I was just, no, I don't want the whole Mahomes family. I'm out on that. I would much rather see, like, perfume commercials and shots from Italy. Which is better, Russ and his social media or Patrick Mahomes' family?
Russ really needs to stop tweeting his videos too in January and February. Like, just
did you see Mahomes' fiance with the champagne and stuff after? Did you see all that?
No.
So after the game, she's spraying champagne all over the people below her.
Oh, classic.
And they were like, what the heck? People were really mad online and telling her, like, what are you doing? She's like, anybody who doesn't like that just doesn't want to let me have fun and wants to control me and all this and that. G had the absolute best response to this. I love it. I was laughing out loud at this one. His response is, let's see you do that to people in the suite and see what happens.
Yeah.
Well, you're just fine spraying the people below you in the stands who've been outside watching a game for 3.5 hours. Mm-hmm. Let's see you turn around into the owner's suite and start spraying people and see how that would go.
Not well.
Yeah, you'd stop in a hurry.
Not
so that's a pretty good point.
I will say, though, man, Josh Allen's closing the gap.
He's number two.
He's closing the gap.
Is this the most wrong I've ever been about anything in my life?
I'm right there with you. I'm going to hold your hand right through this.
Don't do that.
Thomas Rawls. The Thomas Rawls.
That was one thing.
You're very, very wrong.
That was one thing, and it was
very,
quick.
Very, very. Justin Smoke, also, you're super high up on that one, too.
All right, but that's like being high in a prospect. Those guys don't work out all the time. I, like, bet the farm on Josh Allen being terrible, and it looked like it was going to be pretty accurate. I mean, he was not good his first year.
Well, we're all going to have to hold hands on this, because it also breaks one of my old axioms and adages in scouting that I believe, and that is you can improve accuracy, but you can't wholesale change it. You have the command that you have as a pitcher. You have the shooting touch that you have as a shooter. You have the natural innate accuracy as a quarterback passer. And right now, he is challenging that one tremendously.
I got to say, Brock, I'm really glad to hear you say that. Really, like, seriously happy to hear you say that. Because I actually blame you for my feelings about Josh Allen.
No,
like,
you don't.
I do a little bit, because I am. I'm just gonna dump this right on you.
You didn't like anything.
You started
about
full
him.
Accountability. You've now completely switched, just shirking onto somebody else.
I didn't know Brock was going to admit that in the entirety of my belief that to quarterbacks can't get more accurate was based on his belief and me listening to him.
Yes.
And so the reason, like, I didn't like Josh Allen at the beginning, mostly because he's the D2 guy thing. And I just don't believe in those guys in general. And usually they don't work out. Right? I mean, usually they're not. He's sort of the exception. Carson Wentz, terrible. And, those guys generally aren't very good. But he started off super inaccurate. Brock tells me you can't fix that. I'm like, oh, he's never going to be good.
Yep.
And now he's accurate.
Yeah.
Now how did that happen?
Pretty accurate. Well, there's, I think, a few factors. I think number one, I think there's something to be said for late bloomers. Right. And he was not a D2 guy. He was at Wyoming, but I understand your point. It's not
1AA, whatever.
Power five. But no, they're a group of five. They're in the Mountain West. Yes. They're in the Mountain West.
That's
Conference.
Not an FCS school?
No.
What?
No, they go to bowl games.
No, they don't.
Yes, they
That's
do.
That's not true. You're making that with those brown uniforms?
Yeah. They
don't go to bowl games.
All the same, Mike, he had several under 40% completion games in his last year at Wyoming.
I know. Yep. There was a. I think he did that when he first got to Buffalo, too. Like, it looked like he could not complete
he
passes.
He was as raw as you get. When he went both to college, he had to write letters, right? He was a two-star recruit. I sent you the tweet.
But when does that ever work? When does getting the totally raw, talented guy actually work with a quarterback in the NFL?
Not very often.
Never.
Not very often. And I can't even say, Mike, because, you know, obviously,
give me
I don't
another
have these conversations
on,
with you guys.
Yes. Give me another example. Give me one other totally raw, skills, toolsy, talented guy who got to the NFL totally with the tools and then figured it out once he got there.
I mean, Ben Roethlisberger was at Miami, Ohio, which is in the MAC, which is also Group of Five. It's not 1AA. And he was of similar size, somewhat similar delivery. Yeah. He, too, ran around. I think he had the lowest rating Super Bowl win ever to this date against the Seahawks
in 2005. He had sort of a traditional quarterback path at that point. Like, they, you know, it was, you sort of limit them what they do early, and then you kind of expand it over time. Mm-hmm. You could put him in that category, certainly.
Yeah, I think he'd probably just size, skill, talent. He was, you know, ran around like crazy, couldn't sack him, couldn't bring him down, extended plays, played again at a Group of Five level, was more refined, had better statistics. I mean, Josh, the reason he wasn't 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 in that class, I think he went 7th, was because of that accuracy, that the percentage was so low. He also played in a wind tunnel at 7,200 feet in Laramie that ended up playing a factor.
Well, he does that in Buffalo, and now he's accurate. It's amazing.
Here's the thing that's really just a double whammy right between my eyes. It's not as if he has wholesale changed his mechanics. The ball is still pretty low.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he still kind of slings it. Now, his footwork has improved dramatically. Unlike maybe Mike 10, 15, 25 years ago, he works with Jordan Palmer. He's got all the technology in the world, all the video, just like pitchers do today, which is probably why you see guys grow in velocity. You see them grow in command. They can measure spin rate, right? Kirby, we were talking about him, last week on the podcast, goes from a high 80s, low 90s to now mid 90s, mechanically, the biomechanics, all of the video, all of the study, all of it. And he has gone wholesale into that and has spent his off seasons refining those things. So, you know, it has changed, and he is kind of example number one to me, like, hey man, be careful. And I think even McShay said this morning in a tweet I was reading. He's like, hey man, Mahomes, I didn't have him, you know, number one. I didn't have him in my top 10 because mechanically he was so flawed. But I think we got to be careful in seeing, you know, what they look like mechanically or even accuracy wise in college and saying that's who they're going to be forever, because those two are breaking the mold.
Well, I'll tell you, I may have been wrong on that one for sure, even though you're partially at fault. I will take the hit on this one. No, I was dead wrong on Josh Allen, have been all along. I've not been wrong on Bruce Arians. He totally screwed that game up. Whew. What a mess. Right? What a mess from Bruce. His team was completely undisciplined, didn't tackle, gave up 60 yards in completely unnecessary penalties. Yep. And then at the end of the game, they can't even communicate in the right defensive play call. And what they do get puts a safety on Cooper Kupp. Come on.
He's got Tom Brady questioning whether or not he should even stick himself in that position again.
Tom Brady's going to retire because he can't be with Bruce anymore.
Uh-oh, whoops.
I got to apologize because I thought Bruce's look that he's going for on the sidelines was just his own look. And it turns out it's a health issue.
Sort of.
He's got a nerve that he can't wear that belt around.
Right. Yeah. So sad. He's got to put it out there for the world. He can't put it under anything. There's no other way to do it other than to have the.
It's like Urban Meyer can't coach in a lot of places because he keeps getting sick when things go bad.
Did you hear Urban Meyer say that the losing was the world? I couldn't stomach the losing. Oh, that's why I had to leave. Was it that or because nobody could stomach you, Urban? Yes. I think it may have been more the latter than the former.
This is Brock and Salk's Blue 88.
Blue 88! Blue 88!
We take you to the field as Brock Heward breaks down three football questions as only he can.
Now here's your hosts, Brock Heward and Mike Salk.
All right, little Blue 88, Brock. Here we go. Question number one for you. Joe Burrow says that SEC venues were louder and harder to play in than NFL stadiums. That actually sounds right to me.
Yes, until this weekend. This weekend he is going
Kansas
to
City.
Kansas City. People have asked me this at different times, and I kind of suggested this question, or I sent that to you because I wanted to reflect back on the 2003 divisional round. It was outside of sometimes in the old CenturyLink field, Lumen field now, where it is overwhelming, right? Where, I mean, truly overwhelming. Gosh, I point to a game at Husky Stadium. We actually played Army when I was redshirting, and I had never heard the stadium that loud. Oregon, super, super loud. Arrowhead Stadium in the divisional round of the playoffs. I could not talk to the person next to me. I could not communicate. I could not hear the play call, right? So had helmet off, whatever, little thing in my ear, trying to let, nope, had to put my helmet back on, cover my ears on the sidelines to just try to hear the call. Arrowhead this weekend, Joe Burrow will be asked after the game. I think the Chiefs are going to win. I think they'll win handily. And Joe Burrow is going to be asked after the game, well, did that match Death Valley? Did that match Auburn on the Plains? Did that match some of these SEC stadiums that you said were louder in both energy and in volume? And he's going to say, that was the loudest. It will be deafening for him and the Bengals and play a role in getting the Chiefs to the Super Bowl Sunday.
Yeah, I'm still not surprised, though, that in general it's tougher in college. And I don't know, I kind of like people mentioning how things can get harder. Did you see any of John Rahm on the hot mic stuff? He didn't realize that it was
no.
Like, he was basically saying, like, yeah, they're going to make these courses harder. And not like, hey, I'm the number one player in the world, it's too easy for me. He's like, these courses are too easy for pros. I mean, we're turning this just into a putting competition. It's not as good as it could be. Mm-hmm. Make the courses harder and let the best rise to the top.
Yep.
I think that's I like when people and players.
And you only have in college 6 home games. They are destinations, especially in the South, in the SEC country, that they build up for all week. The NFL, there's a ton of environments that get super stale the second half of the year once teams are out of it. And even if their teams are engaged, it's just not the same zeal and passion you find in the South.
All right, question number 2. So how is it that the NFC works this way, where the Seahawks own the Niners own the Rams, and the Rams own the Seahawks? What are the Niners, or what are the, I mean, how do the Rams try to borrow from the Seahawks to beat the Niners this weekend?
Well, some of that is Russell's ability to move. Now, the Seahawks have not had the Rams number either, right? And I think herein is going to be the challenge for the Rams. The Seahawks have certainly had the Niners number, right? They've beaten them how many different times in a row now, or Russell's career? I mean, it's just, it's weird. It doesn't make sense, because you would think the Niners and the Rams pull from the same playbook, which is rush four, dominate the line of scrimmage, swallow Russell whole, and then spit out, you know, the leftovers and beat them. But for some reason, the Seahawks have been able, and Russell in particular, has been able to create, make things happen against the Niners, unlike the Rams. The Rams have just not had any balance, and it has been the biggest challenge. And, you know, they went down to Tampa over the weekend and said, screw it. We're not even going to try to run. Vita Vea is in the game. That's the number one rush defense. Hey, Matthew Stafford, our run game is going to be an extension. It's going to be bubbles. It's going to be option routes. It's going to be getting the ball out of your hand. And I think that they have still, strived in the regular season to have some balance and be able to run it. And they've not been able to run that wide zone. That San Francisco front seven has dominated this matchup. I think they've got to take a page out of their playbook of what they did to Tampa, and that is really use the passing game and trust Matthew Stafford in a way they did not trust Jared Goff. Many of those matchups, were Jared Goff at the helm, and we got to have balance, got to have play action. I think they're going to throw it a bunch more than they're going to run it and try to beat the Niners.
I didn't remember, but Mora found me the sound of McVay last year when he was done with Goff. Like, get him out of my sight. I can't even look at him. I don't remember that.
I don't either.
Sheesh.
Is that bad?
Yeah. Like, get this guy away from me. I don't see him anymore. Question number 3. Hey, I'll throw you a bone here, a little college football question. What's going on at UW, football staff? What are we hearing so far about what Kalen DeBoer is doing?
Recruiting is slow. Slow. A couple transfers. Transfer from back east. Howdy, I'm blanking. Where did he come? Pitt linebacker. Right. Good player.
Brock, that's one of your official visits right there.
Yeah, Pitt was one of my official visits. You're absolutely right.
I know.
Johnny Majors.
Come on now.
Yeah, way to go. Things. Good memory. So recruiting is still a slow process, but I've kind of asked around, and obviously people close to the program, and what are some of the early word, and they love the strength coach, man. And that is right now, January, February, leading into spring ball, much like June, July, leading into training camp, is all about your strength and development program. And Tim Saha was a great guy, the previous conditioning coach, strength coach, loved him, terrific human being, wonderful guy, did some good things with some of their personnel, but not the entirety of their personnel. And I think there is just a lot of praise, a lot of affirmation, a lot of buy-in. One of the things that does come in struggle, Mike, and last year was a struggle to say the least, is you do and can get more buy-in. ZTF decides to come back to school. I think some of that is also what he is witnessing, what he is experiencing with this staff, with the strength staff in particular. That is a group that's got to get leaner up front on their offensive line. It's a group that's got to get stronger on that offensive line. And so far, the early report's pretty positive out of Montlake.
I'll tell you what, man, I'm glad to have you back. I was worried earlier in the show that you had just turned too negative and that I had infected you in some way. It's nice to see some of that 09 Brock Huard just stepping back in by the end of the show. Thank you. That's good to see. We were talking a little bit beforehand here just about and that's Blue 88, yes. We were talking a little bit earlier about just where the baseball negotiations are
at. Feels like there's a little momentum,
lot of good momentum. I mean, they're basically caving. I mean, both sides are...
Oh, there's my soul.
They're making, what do they call them?
Thanks.
Selling signals, right? Of like... Hey, I'm willing to give up on this. Cool, I'm willing to give up on that. Like they're dancing around each other and seeming like they're getting closer.
They're sending messages across battle lines.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, let's figure out a way to give in. It does seem like the players are going to retreat.
Do you think do you think there is anything with these players looking at what the NFL is doing right now, realizing the NFL pushed through the pandemic, right, with the draft, the season, they didn't miss a game. I know there were largely empty stadiums, but they played through it all. They're playing through it this year. The ratings are absolutely off the charts. It's just, right, it's front of mind for everybody. You think baseball is realizing like, hey,
no,
man.
I don't think it's that.
You don't think there's anything to do with that?
Nope, players? I think it's very simple. I think when the baseball union formed in the 70s and became one of the strongest in the country, they were doing battle against owners that were wealthy. The baseball union that is trying to do battle against the owners today is doing battle against a group that is so much wealthier than that group was 45 years ago that there's nothing they can do. That group, the owners
playing
today.
Playing field in the 70s, much like it was in some ways for the NFL, but they caved even in the 80s with Gene Upshaw in the 90s.
Yep.
The playing field to
the
negotiate.
Baseball union, just, they don't have the same leverage that they used to.
It's just
they have roughly the same leverage that the NFL union, that the NFL players union does now. And so they're going to eat it. I don't think they can win. And I think they sort of are starting to recognize that this big and mighty and bad as the baseball union maybe used to be, mm-hmm. it's not that way anymore, and that they are not that different from the NFL. And these owners are so strong and so powerful, and there's so much television money that they can just wait it out and they don't care. And because of that, the players are eventually going to give in. They're not going to change the fundamental structure of how the game is played. They'll get some small concessions. They'll get the minimum wage raised, which they should. Mm-hmm. They'll go from 570 to 6 something or even 7 something, and that'll be a win for them.
And they'll get some incentives for younger players pre-arbitration. If they're playing, they should absolutely have a pool to make money.
I like that. I like the bonus pool for guys who are in arbitration who are far exceeding their contract, but they are not going to change when free agency starts. They are not going to make it age-based. They're not going to make these real fundamental changes to the game because people are making enough money.
And the Players Association Executive Board is filled with some of the highest paid players in the game.
There you go.
And the stuff that they're actually getting traction on the movement is for the very, very, very best players in the game.
Yeah, and I hate kind of the things that the things the Players Association wants that they are like giving in on, or like, oh, they want a draft lottery. Like, God. Because you think that's going to stop teams from tanking? That's garbage.
Watch the NBA, how that draft lottery has really worked for them to separate the good from bad.
So ridiculous.
There's definitely not tanking teams in the NBA.
No, definitely not.
Yeah, the lottery fixed that.
And then the other thing they want is, oh, well, we want to raise the amount that the luxury tax hits at. That just means that the very, very richest teams are going to spend a little bit more, which is bad for the consumer. So we'll see where this goes. It'll get done. And I think we'll end up even having some sort of a spring training when it's all said and done. Brock, fun conversation today. We will do it again next week. Happy birthday to Molly. Hope she has a great time. And we'll talk to you next week. The Hay
Barn.
See everybody.
This is the chopper!